Hello, and welcome to The Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to resume with Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf, Thomas Dalton translation. We're going to do Volume 2, Chapter 13, the first half of it, Sections 13.1 through 13.12, and there are 23 total in it. Chapter 13 is called German Post-War Alliance Policy. So there's a lot of fairly specific stuff in this chapter. Let's get into it. Chapter 13 of Volume 2, German Post-War Alliance Policy, post-World War I, that is, of course. The erratic conduct of Reich foreign affairs was due to a lack of sound guiding principles for an effective alliance policy. Not only did this continue after the revolution, but it became even worse. 13.1, Reasons for the Breakdown. The confused state of our political ideas in general before the war may be regarded as the chief cause of our defective leadership, but in the post-war period, it was a lack of honest intentions. It was natural that those circles who had fully achieved their destructive goal by means of the revolution had no interest in an alliance policy that would ultimately result in the restoration of a free German state. Jews destroying the old Reich don't want a new free German state. Not only would a development in this direction have run opposed to the inner sentiment of the November crime, not only would it have interrupted and indeed put an end to the internationalization of the German economy and labor, but mainly the domestic political effects of a successful fight for freedom from foreign countries would, in the future, be disastrous for those who now hold power in the Reich. And he's talked earlier, we've heard about them basically taking the functional parts of the Reich and selling them off to Wall Street, essentially. He wants to get Germany out of this international Jewish global financial system that is perverting everything and turning it to the benefit of the Jews and against the benefit of the Germans, selling off the railway system and the postal system he's mentioned specifically. One cannot imagine the revival of a nation unless preceded by a process of nationalization, just as, conversely, every important success in the field of foreign politics must produce a favorable reaction at home. Experience proves that every struggle for freedom increases the national sentiment and self-consciousness, and therefore gives rise to a sharper sensibility towards anti-national elements and tendencies. Conditions and persons who are tolerated and even pass unnoticed in peace times, conditions and people you don't notice in peacetime, will not only become the object of aversion when national enthusiasm is aroused, but will even provoke a resistance that not seldom brings their doom. One may recall, for example, the spy scare that prevails when war breaks out, when human passions suddenly reach such heights that they lead to the most brutal and even unjust persecutions. Although everyone knows that the danger of spies is greater during long periods of peace, but for obvious reasons they don't receive the same attention. For this reason, the subtle instinct of the state parasites who surface during the November events makes them feel at once that an intelligent alliance policy that would restore our people's freedom and awaken national sentiment might possibly destroy their own criminal existence. And he has talked earlier about how Germany had two real choices, to ally with England or ally with Russia, and it did neither, and how bad it was to ally with Italy in the Entente. Thus, we may understand the fact that since 1918, governmental authorities have failed us in foreign affairs, and that state leaders have almost constantly and systematically worked against the interests of the German nation. That which at first sight seems a matter of chance has proven, on closer examination, to be a logical advance along the path that was first opened by the 1918 November Revolution. Undoubtedly, a distinction should be made between the responsible, or better, should be responsible, leaders of our state affairs, the average contemptible parliamentary politicians, the great stupid herd of our patient, sheep-like people. The first know what they want. The second play along either because they know it or because they're too cowardly to oppose that which they know and feel to be detrimental. The others just submit from incomprehension and stupidity. 13.2, aim of foreign policy, freedom tomorrow. While the National Socialist German Workers' Party was only a small and practically unknown group, foreign policy problems had only a secondary importance in the eyes of many of its members. This was the case especially because our movement has always proclaimed, and must proclaim, the principle that external freedom is not a gift from heaven, or any earthly powers, but can only be the fruit of a development of our inner strength. Freedom is the product of our inner strength, and that goes for you personally and us collectively as Team White. Only by the elimination of the causes that led to our collapse and the destruction of all those who profit from it can we fight for the restoration of our external freedom. One can easily understand, therefore, why we didn't place much value on foreign affairs during the early period of our young movement, but preferred to work on internal reform plans. But when the small and insignificant group expanded and finally broke its bounds, the young organization assumed the importance of a great association, and the necessity arose of taking a stand on questions regarding developments in foreign policy. It was necessary to lay down the main lines of action that would not only be in accord with the fundamental views of our world concept, but would actually be an expansion of it. Precisely due to our lack of public education in foreign affairs, it was necessary to teach the leaders in our young movement, and also the broad masses, the chief principles that should guide the development of our foreign relations. This is the prerequisite for the practical implementation of a foreign policy that would win back national independence and thus restore the real sovereignty of the Reich. The fundamental and guiding principle that we must always bear in mind when studying this question is that foreign policy is only a means to an end, and that the sole end is the promotion of our own people. All consideration of foreign policy must proceed from only this viewpoint. Does it benefit our people now or in the future, or will it be harmful? This is the sole preoccupation that must occupy us in dealing with this question. Party politics, religion, humanitarianism, all other viewpoints are totally irrelevant. Does it benefit our people now or in the future, or will it be harmful? All consideration of foreign policy revolves around those questions. Good for us or bad for us? 13.3, precondition for the liberation of lost regions. Remember, Germany is a small state, even though it's big for Europe, but it's small for the world. That was actually, someone said that Germany's basic problem is it's too big for Europe and too small for the world. It doesn't have a massive amount of land like the United States, protection from barriers like water on either side, or Russia, where you have essentially a land sea with a cold, frozen north that people can't get in over the top of you. And, you know, to an extent, some mountains to the south, although they do have a border with China that could be overrun fairly easily, but in any case, they're more on the edge, which is easier to defend, like Britain, surrounded by water, even though it's very tiny. So, and then you've got World War I and the bad result, and you have land that is full of German people and German culture being turned over to Poland and other nations, Czechoslovakia. So, 13.3, precondition for the liberation of lost regions. Before the war, the purpose of German foreign policy should have been to assure the sustenance of our people and their children by preparing a way that would lead to this goal, and we should have established the necessary alliances to assist us. Today, it's the same, but with one difference. In pre-war times, it was a question of caring for the maintenance of the German people, supported by the power of a strong and independent state. But today we must make our nation powerful once again by reestablishing a strong and independent state. So you're one step back, and it's a huge step. You've lost control of your state to internal Jews and other bad people. This is the prerequisite for implementing a practical foreign policy that will preserve, promote, and sustain our people in the future. In other words, the goal of today's German foreign policy must be to prepare for the recovery of its freedom tomorrow. There's a fundamental principle that we must always keep in mind. The possibility of winning back national independence is not absolutely bound up with territorial reintegration. It will suffice if a remnant of this nation and state, no matter how small, exists, provided it possesses the necessary independence to not only embody the common spirit of the whole people, but also to prepare the military fight for freedom. That's worth quoting, and in fact, I'm going to put it on my social media. There's so many little nuggets from him that are valuable to remember and clip and save. When a nation of 100 million people tolerates the yoke of common slavery in order to preserve territorial integrity, it's worse than if such a state and such a people were dismembered while only one fragment retained complete freedom. Of course, the condition here is that this fragment must be inspired by a holy mission, not only to proclaim its spiritual and cultural unity, but also to prepare the military for the final liberation and reunion of the oppressed fragments. One must also bear in mind the fact that the question of restoring lost regions that were formerly parts of the people and the state must primarily be a question of winning back political power and independence for the motherland itself, and that in such cases the interest of the lost regions must be uncompromisingly subordinated to regaining freedom for the main territory. The detached and oppressed fragments of a nation or an imperial province cannot be liberated through the yearnings and protest of the oppressed and abandoned, but only through the means of force and of reconquering the more or less sovereign remnants of the common fatherland. All this in the bottom of page 659, go on to 660. Therefore, in order to reconquer lost regions, the precondition is the intensive promotion and strengthening of that portion of the remnant state. The unquenchable yearning that slumbers in the heart must dedicate the new arising force, when the hour comes, to the freedom and unification of the whole people. Therefore, the interests of the separated regions must be subordinated to the one purpose of acquiring sufficient political power and strength for the remnant state to correct the hostile will of the victorious enemy. Not flaming protests, but only the mighty sword will restore oppressed territories to the bosom of a common Reich. The forging of this sword is the task of a nation's internal political leadership. To secure this task and to seek out comrades in arms is the task of foreign policy. 13.4. Mistaken Continental Policy Before the War. In the first volume of this work, I discussed the inadequacy of our pre-war alliance policy. Yes, he did at great length. 186 footnote, see sections 4.2 and 4.3 in volume 1. Of the four possible ways to secure the future preservation and sustenance of our people, the fourth and least favorable was chosen, that to make it an economic world power. And he said it should, in fact, spread out territorially eastward toward Russia. Instead of a healthy European land policy, we adopted a colonial and commercial policy. This was all the more mistaken, inasmuch as it was presumed that armed conflict could be avoided. The result of the attempt to sit on many chairs at once led us to fall to the ground amidst all of them, falling between two stools. And the World War was only the final reckoning presented to the Reich for its foreign policy failure. You chose the wrong foreign policy. It resulted partly in a war and showed you the error of your ways. You should have done what I said and admit honestly that you needed to acquire land in Russia by arms. The right way would have been the third, strengthening our continental power by acquiring new territory in Europe. And at the same time, the subsequent acquisition of colonial territory might thus be brought within the range of natural possibility. Of course, this policy could only have been carried out in alliance with England, or by devoting such abnormal efforts to the increase of military power that for 40 or 50 years, all cultural undertakings would have been pushed to the background. This responsibility might very well have been accepted. A nation's cultural importance is almost always dependent on its political freedom and independence, and the former is a necessary precondition for the existence, or better, creation, of the latter. Therefore, no sacrifice is too great for the securing of political freedom. What might be lost from cultural purposes in order to meet demands for increasing the state's military power can be generously paid back later on. Indeed, one can observe that, after a concentrated effort for the purpose of securing its political independence, a certain period of ease and compensation often sets in which the previously neglected cultural forces of the nation now suddenly burst forth and bloom. Out of the Persian War, Greece witnessed the blossom of the Age of Pericles, and after the sorrow of the Punic Wars, the Roman state began to dedicate itself to the service of a higher culture. Footnote 187. Ancient Greece was engaged in a series of military conflicts with Persia from roughly 500 to 450 BC, peaking in two major wars in 490 BC and 480 BC. The great Athenian statesman Pericles was influential from the end of the wars to his death in 429 BC and oversaw a period of remarkable cultural flourishing. It was called the Golden Age. The Punic Wars were a series of three major battles between Rome and Carthage of North Africa between 264 and 146 BC. With the final defeat of Carthage, Rome assumed dominant power in the larger Mediterranean region for some 500 years. Reads footnote 187. Of course, it couldn't be expected that a parliamentary majority of idiots or good-for-nothings would be capable of subordinating all other national interests to the one sole task of preparing for a future arms conflict that would establish state security. The father of Frederick the Great sacrificed everything for that conflict, but the fathers of our democratic parliamentary nonsense of the Jewish variety could never do it. That's why in pre-war times, the military preparation for an acquisition of European territory was very limited, and thus Allied support was indispensable. Unfortunately, our leaders wouldn't even consider the idea of systematically preparing for war. They rejected the acquisition of European territory, and, by preferring a colonial and trade policy, they sacrificed an alliance with England that would have been possible. They also neglected Russian support, which would have been logical. Finally, they stumbled into the World War, abandoned by all except the ill-fated Habsburgs in Austria. 13.5. Present European power relations, England and Germany. The characteristic of our present foreign policy is that there are no discernible or even intelligible lines of conduct. Whereas before the war, the fourth way was mistakenly followed, and this only in a half-hearted manner, not even the sharpest eye can detect any path that's being followed since the revolution. Even more than before the war, there's no systemic plan except the attempts to smash the last possibility of a national revival. An objective assessment of present-day European power relations leads to the following results. For the past 300 years, the history of our continent has been fundamentally determined by England's efforts to keep the European states opposed to one another in an equilibrium of forces, thus assuring the necessary protection of its own rear while pursuing the great aims of British world policy. The traditional tendency of British diplomacy ever since the reign of Queen Elizabeth, 188, reigned from 1558 to 1603, Queen Elizabeth, has been to systematically employ every possible means to prevent any one European power from dominating over the others, and, if necessary, to break it by means of armed intervention. The only parallel to this has been the Prussian army's tradition. England made use of various military means to carry out its purpose, choosing them according to the actual situation or the task to be faced, but the determination and willpower to use them has always been the same. Indeed, the more difficult England's position became in the course of history, the more the leadership of the British Empire considered it necessary to maintain a condition of political paralysis among the various European states as a result of their mutual rivalries. The political independence of the North American colonies made it even more necessary to use every effort to maintain the defense of Britain's flank in Europe. And so, after the destruction of Spain and the Netherlands as great sea powers, England concentrated all its forces against the increasing strength of France until, with the downfall of Napoleon, the hegemony danger of this perilous military power was finally broken. The shift in British policy against Germany took place only very slowly. This was true not only because the German nation did not represent an obvious danger for England as long as it lacked national unification, but also because British public opinion, steered by propaganda toward other goals, was slow to move in a new direction. The calm knowledge of the statesman is transformed into popular sentiment, which is not only more effective, but also more durable. When the statesman has attained one of his goals, he can immediately turn his thoughts to new ones. But only by the slow work of propaganda can mass sentiment be shaped into an instrument for the leader's new view on life. And that's before TV, of course. Because with TV, you find it changing almost daily. As early as 1870, 1871, England had decided on its new stance. At times, minor policy fluctuations were caused by the growing importance of America in the world economy, and also by the increasing political power of Russia. Unfortunately, though, Germany didn't take advantage of these events, and therefore the original tendency of British diplomacy was only reinforced. England saw Germany as a power of commercial and world political importance, partly because its enormous industrialization. England saw Germany as a power of commercial and world political, hyphenated, importance, partly because of its enormous industrialization was increasing to such threatening proportions that the two countries were already contending as equals in the commercial markets. The peaceful economic conquest, not his term, but he's using it in apostrophes, the peaceful economic conquest of the world, which, in the eyes of our leaders, represented the highest peak of wisdom, was what led English statesmen to adopt a policy of resistance. The fact that this resistance assumed the form of a vast organized aggression was in full conformity with the type of statesmanship that aimed not at the maintenance of a dubious world peace, but at the consolidation of British world domination. England thus allied itself with those countries that had a definite military importance, and this was consistent with its traditional caution in estimating the adversary's power, and also in recognizing its own temporary weakness. It wasn't prepared for war. This cannot be called unscrupulous, because such a comprehensive organization for war purposes must not be judged from the heroic viewpoint, but from that of expediency. Diplomacy must see to it, not that a nation goes down heroically, but rather that it survives in practice. Hence, every road that leads to this goal is expedient, and the failure to take it must be seen as a criminal neglect of duty. When the German Revolution occurred, England's fears of a German world hegemony came to a satisfactory end. Since then, it has not been in English interest to see Germany totally erased from the geographic map of Europe. On the contrary, the astounding collapse that took place in November 1918 confronted British diplomacy with a situation that at first appeared impossible. For 4.5 years, the British Empire fought to break the presumed prevalence of a continental power. A sudden collapse now occurred that removed this power from the picture. That collapse exposed the lack of even a basic instinct of self-preservation, such that European equilibrium was unhinged within 48 hours. Germany destroyed, and France the first European continental power. The enormous propaganda that was carried on during this war for the purpose of encouraging the British public to hold out aroused all the primitive instincts and passions of the populace and was bound to eventually hang as a lead weight on the decisions of British statesmen. With the colonial, economic, and commercial destruction of Germany, England's war aims were attained. Anything beyond this was a hindrance to British interests. Only England's enemies could profit by the disappearance of Germany as a continental power in Europe. Nonetheless, from November 1918 through midsummer 1919, it was no longer possible for England to change its diplomatic attitude because it had expended the emotional energy of the broad masses, teaching them the Germans were beasts, baby killers. It wasn't possible from the viewpoint of existing attitudes of its own people, and it wasn't possible due to the military relation of forces. France took the initiative and could impose upon others. During those months of negotiations and bargaining, the only power that could have altered the course of things, Germany itself, was torn asunder by a civil war, and its so-called statesmen declared themselves ready to accept any dictate. Now, in the life of peoples, if one nation loses its instinct for self-preservation and ceases to be an active ally, It sinks to the level of an enslaved people, and its territory must suffer the fate of a colony. 13.6. England's war aim not achieved. To prevent France from becoming too great a power, England had to participate in a predatory lust. In fact, England did not attain its war aim. Not only was it impossible to prevent the rise of a European power above the continental state system, but it was given increased support. In 1914, Germany, considered as a military state, was wedged between two countries, one of which had equal power and the other greater. Then there was England's overwhelming sea power. France and Russia alone hindered and opposed the development of German greatness. The Reich's unfavorable military geographical situation might be looked upon as another coefficient of security against an exaggerated and increased power. From a naval viewpoint, the coastline was unfavorable for a conflict with England, as it was short and cramped. The land frontier, by contrast, was widely extended and open. France's position is different today. It is the first military power without a serious rival on the continent. It's almost entirely protected along its southern border with Spain and Italy by the mountains. Against Germany, it's safeguarded by the prostrate condition of our fatherland, and a long stretch of its coastline faces the vital nerve system of the British Empire. Not only could French airplanes and long-range batteries attack the vital centers of England, but submarines could threaten its sea lanes. A submarine campaign based on the long Atlantic coast and on the European and North African coasts of the Mediterranean would have disastrous effects. Thus, the political result of the war to prevent the development of German power was French hegemony on the continent. The military result, the consolidation of France as the first continental power and the recognition of the Union as an equal sea power. The economic result, the surrender of great spheres of British interest to former allies. 13.7. Political goals of France and England. Just as England's traditional political goals wanted and required the Balkanization of Europe, France's desired the Balkanization of Germany. England's wish is and remains to prevent any one continental power from attaining a position of world importance, that is, the maintenance of a definite balance of power among the European states. This seems to be a precondition for British world hegemony. France's wish is, and remains, to prevent Germany from becoming a unified power. It wants to maintain a system of small German states with balanced power relations and without central leadership, and it wants to possess the left bank of the Rhine as a prerequisite for the establishment and safeguarding of hegemony in Europe. The final aims of French diplomacy will be in perpetual opposition to the final tendencies of British statesmanship. 13.8. Alliance possibilities for Germany. Taking this as a starting point, anyone who investigates alliance possibilities for Germany must come to the conclusion that there remains no other option except to approach England. The consequences of England's war policy were and are disastrous for Germany, but we cannot close our eyes to the fact that, today, England has no necessary interest in the destruction of Germany. Indeed, on the contrary, England's diplomacy must, from year to year, tend more towards curbing France's unbridled lust after hegemony. Now an alliance policy cannot be pursued by bearing grudges, but it can be rendered fruitful by taking account of past experiences. Experience should have taught us that alliances formed for negative purposes suffer from intrinsic weaknesses. The destinies of nations can be welded together only under the prospect of a common success, of common gain, and conquest, in short, a mutual extension of power. The ignorance of our people on foreign politics is clearly demonstrated by current press reports about friendship towards Germany by one or other foreign statesman, whereby this is taken as a special guarantee of a policy that will be beneficial to our people. This is absolutely unbelievable nonsense, mere speculation of unparalleled simplicity by the average German man. No British, American, or Italian statesman ever was pro-German. Every English statesman will naturally be English, first of all. Every American, American, and no Italian statesman would be prepared to adopt a policy that wasn't pro-Italian. Therefore, anyone who expects to form alliances with foreign nations on the basis of a pro-German feeling among their statesmen is either an ass or a deceiver. The premise for linking together the destinies of nations is never mutual esteem or mutual sympathy, but rather the prospect of advantages for both contracting parties. That is, it's true that an English statesman will always follow a pro-English and not a pro-German policy, but so too is it true that certain definite interests involved in this pro-English policy may coincide on various grounds with German interests. Naturally, this can only be true to a certain degree, and may one day be completely reversed. Remember that statement, England has no permanent friends, only permanent interest. But the art of statesmanship is shown when, at certain periods, allies are found who must take the same road in order to defend their own interests. The practical application of these principles at the present time depends on the answer given to the following questions. What states at present have no interest in allowing French military and economic power to achieve hegemony through the total exclusion of a German Central Europe? Indeed, which states see this as a threat to their own future, based on their own requirements for existence and on their previous political tradition? Ultimately, we must be very clear on this point. France is and will remain Germany's implacable mortal enemy. It doesn't matter what governments have ruled or will rule. France, whether Bourbon or Jacobin, Napoleonic, or bourgeois democratic, clerical republican, or red Bolshevik, their foreign policy will always be directed toward acquiring possession of the Rhine frontier and to consolidating France's position on this river by dismembering and shattering Germany. England doesn't want Germany to be a world power, but France wants no power at all called Germany. Quite an essential difference. Today we are not fighting for our position as a world power, but rather only for the existence of our fatherland, for national unity, and for our children's daily bread. From this viewpoint, only two European states remain as possible allies, England and Italy. England doesn't want to see a French military fist unchecked by the rest of Europe, one that might adopt a policy that would clash with English interests one day. England never wants to see France possess the immense Western European iron and coal deposits that would make it possible for it to gain a threatening economic world position. And England, furthermore, never wants a France whose continental position, owing to the dismemberment of the rest of Europe, seems so absolutely assured that it not only enabled but compelled to resume a French world policy on great lines. Zeppelin bombs might be multiplied by the thousand every night. France's military predominance weighs heavily on the heart of Great Britain's world empire. Footnote 189. Doesn't this seem so antiquated today when these are such little buggery little stupid nations that are completely dominated by Jews and invaded by Africans? So this stuff is now gone by the boards, and now its whites just have to worry. But like he says, a remnant can save itself. As long as it has freedom, it can grow and expand and develop. And that's the position we're in. It's much worse than what he's talking about. 189. It's hard to envision, says Dalton, the extent of the British Empire at the time this was written. It encompassed over 400 million people, about 20% of the global total. It covered roughly a quarter of the Earth's entire land surface area, including such present-day nations as Canada, Australia, India, Pakistan, Egypt, South Africa, Sudan, and Kenya, among many others. bottom page 668. And Italy cannot and will not want any further strengthening of France's power in Europe. Italy's future will always be conditioned by the development of events in the Mediterranean basin. It wasn't a desire to build up France that drove Italy into the war, but rather to deal a mortal blow to its hated Adriatic rival. Any further strengthening of France on the continent would hamper the development of Italy's future, and we mustn't deceive ourselves by thinking that national relations will in any way exclude rivalries. Serious and cool-minded consideration shows that these two states, England and Italy, have natural self-interests that not only are not in opposition to Germany's essential conditions for existence, but are indeed to a certain extent identical with them. 13.9. Is Germany capable of alliance today? But when we consider the possibilities of alliances, we must be careful not to overlook three factors. The first concerns ourselves, and the other two, the states in question. Can anyone ally themselves with present-day Germany? Can a power, one that seeks an alliance for the purpose of securing assistance in carrying out offensive aims, form an alliance with a state whose rulers have, for years, presented a spectacle of deplorable incompetence and pacifist cowardice, and where the majority of the populace, in a democratic Marxist blindness, betrays the interests of their own people and country in a way that cries to high heaven? Can Germany even be aligned with, given the sorry state of its leadership and even its people? Can any power today hope to establish useful relations in the fight for common interest when this state obviously has neither the courage nor the desire to lift a finger, even in the defense of its own naked existence? Can such a power, for which an alliance must be more than a pact to guarantee a state of slow decay, like the disastrous old Triple Alliance, which he discussed at great length, footnote 190, the Triple Alliance was a pact between Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Italy. It was formed in 1882 and survived until the start of World War I. See Volume 1, Sections 4.1 and 4.9. He goes into that quite a bit. Can such a power, for which an alliance must be much more than a pact to guarantee a state of slow decay, like the disastrous old Triple Alliance, associate itself, for better or worse, with a state whose most characteristic signs of life consist of a rampant servility in external relations and a scandalous repression of national virtues at home? Or can it be associated with a state that possesses no greatness because its whole behavior shows that it doesn't deserve it? Or can alliances be made with governments that are despised by their own citizens and thus have no possibility for respect abroad? No. Any self-respecting power that expects something more from alliances than commissions for greedy parliamentarians will not ally itself with our present-day Germany. Indeed, it cannot. Our present inability to form alliances furnishes the deepest and ultimate principle for the solidarity of the enemy thieves. Because Germany doesn't defend itself in any way other except the flamboyant protests of our parliamentarian elect, there is no reason why the rest of the world should fight in our defense. And God does not follow the principle of granting freedom to a nation of cowards, despite all the whimperings of our patriotic associations. Therefore, even for those states that don't have a direct interest in our total destruction, no other course remains except to participate in France's campaign of plunder, or at least to prevent the exclusive strengthening of France alone. Second, we must not overlook the difficulty in overcoming the mass propaganda of our former enemies, which have turned popular opinion toward a fixed direction. When a nationality has been represented to the public for years as a horde of Huns, robbers, vandals, etc., they cannot suddenly overnight be presented as something else, and the former enemy cannot be recommended as the ally of tomorrow. 13.10. Divergence between British and Jewish interests. But the third factor deserves greater attention, since it is of essential importance for establishing future alliances in Europe. From a British state viewpoint, Even though there isn't much interest in the further destruction of Germany, such a development is greatly in the interest of the International Stock Exchange Jews. The cleavage between the official, or rather traditional, British statesmanship and the controlling Jewish stock exchange powers is nowhere so clearly manifested as in the various attitudes on the questions of British foreign policy. Contrary to the interest and welfare of the British state, Jewish finance desires not only the absolute economic destruction of Germany, but its complete political enslavement. The internationalization of our German economy, that is, the transference of our productive forces to Jewish world finance, can only be completely carried out in a politically Bolshevik state. But the Marxist fighting forces of international Jewish stock exchange capital cannot finally smash the German national state without friendly help from the outside. French armies must therefore first besiege the German state structure, and then the exhausted Reich would succumb to the Bolshevik fighting troops of international Jewish world finance. Hence it is that the Jew today is the great agitator for the complete destruction of Germany. Whenever in the world we read of attacks against Germany, Jews are their fabricators. In peacetime and during the war, Jewish stock exchange and Marxist press systematically stirred up hatred against Germany until one state after another abandoned its neutrality and placed itself at the service of the World War Coalition, renouncing the real interests of the people, just as they would do in World War II. What he describes them doing in World War I is exactly what they did against him in Germany in World War II, of course. So it was continuation. 1311, Jewish World Incitement Against Germany. Jews inciting the world against Germany. The Jewish way of reasoning thus becomes clear. The Bolshevization of Germany, that is, the rooting out of national-focused German intellectuals to make it possible for the German labor force to bear the yoke of Jewish world finance, is only a prelude to an extension of the Jewish tendency for world conquest. As so often in our history, Germany is the great pivot in this mighty struggle. If our people and our state should become victims of these bloodthirsty and avaricious Jewish tyrants of nations, the whole earth would fall prey to this polyp. And if Germany were to be freed from its grip, this greatest of dangers to nations would be broken for the whole world. It is certain that Jewry uses all its agitational efforts not only to maintain national animosity toward Germany, but, if possible, to increase it even more. And it's equally certain that only a fraction of these activities are in keeping with the true interests of the poison peoples. In general, Jewry carries on its campaign in the various countries by use of the weapons that are calculated to appeal to the mentality of the respective nations and are most likely to produce the greatest success. In our blood-diluted, exceptionally torn national body, it is more or less cosmopolitan, pacifist ideological thoughts that arise, in short, the international tendencies that they use in their struggle for power. In France, they exploit the well-known and accurately estimated chauvinism, and in England, the commercial and world political outlook. In short, they always work with the essential qualities that belong to each national mentality. When they have in this way achieved a decisive influence in economic and political spheres, they discard the limitations of their borrowed weapons and expose, to the same degree, the true inner purposes of their will and their struggle. Their destruction then accelerates, reducing one state after another to a mass of ruins upon which they will erect the sovereign and eternal Jewish empire. Yep, that's exactly what they're trying to do. In England and Italy, the contrast between the view of the better kind of statesmanship and the policy of the Jewish World Stock Exchange is clear indeed, sometimes strikingly obvious. Only in France today does there exist, more than ever before, a profound accord between the views of the Jew-controlled stock exchange and the chauvinistic national statecraft. This identity constitutes an immense danger for Germany. For this reason, France is and will remain by far the most terrible enemy. This people, who are becoming more and more niggerized, represent an enduring danger to the existence of the white race in Europe because they are bound up with the Jewish goal of world domination. Contamination through Negro blood on the Rhine, in the very heart of Europe, is in accord with the sadistic and perverse lust for vengeance by this hereditary enemy of our people, just as an ice-cold Jewish calculation uses this to begin a bastardization at the center of the European continent and to deprive the white race of the basis for a sovereign existence by infection with a lower humanity. France's activities in Europe today, spurred on by their lust for vengeance and systematically led by the Jews, are a sin against the existence of white humanity. These actions will one day arouse a spirit of vengeance against them by a race that has recognized racial pollution as the original sin of mankind. So whereas the Jews would have us believe that racism is the original sin of whites, racial pollution is the original sin of mankind, says Hitler. For Germany, however, the French danger involves a subordinating of all sentiment and extending a hand to those who are threatened with the same menace and who are unwilling to suffer or tolerate France's lust for domination. For the foreseeable future, there will only be two European allies for Germany, England and Italy. And we'll do one more section, 312, pandering to France. So again, but there you have Hitler making the full racial case. Most of the time he's speaking about Germany, but here he, in 1311, in volume 2, he talks about, yeah, he says, Jews' ice-cold calculation by putting these niggers in the heart of Europe. Yeah, France is doing it for its own reasons, but they're trying to poison the very basis of white existence in Europe by doing that. So Hitler knows exactly what is going on. He would know exactly. He's like, yeah, they've taken it to an nth degree, 100. If he called him back from the grave today and had him look at TV and see, he would say, yeah, they're trying to inject blacks into every little area so that they can destroy the racial existence of whites and they can rule the Jewish empire for all time. The word Jewish slave state, global Jewish slave state, as I like to say it. Last section for this recording, which is number 32. 1312, pandering to France. If we take the trouble to cast a backwards glance at German foreign policy leadership since the revolution, again, always meaning 1919, that period, we must, in view of the constant and incomprehensible failure of our governments, either lose heart or, in a flaming rage, take up the fight against such a regime. Their actions cannot be attributed to a lack of understanding. What seemed inconceivable to every thinking man was accomplished by these intellectual cyclopses of our November parties. They courted France's favor. Yes, indeed, during all these years, with the touching simplicity of an incorrigible visionaries, they pandered to France again and again. They bowed to the great nation, and they believed that they saw a visible change of feeling in every shrewd trick of the French hangman. Naturally, the actual political wire pullers never shared this absurd belief. For them, pandering to France was only an obvious means of thwarting every attempt at a practical alliance policy. They had no illusions about French aims or those of the men behind the scenes, the Jews. What induced them to act as if they honestly believed that the fate of Germany could possibly be changed was the sober calculation that otherwise our people might head off in another direction. Naturally, it's hard for us, within our own movement, to propose England as a future possible ally. Our Jewish press has always been adept at concentrating hatred against England in particular, and many of our good German simpletons have willingly fallen into the Jewish trap. They babble about a strengthening of German sea power and protest against the theft of our colonies, and thus they furnish material that the Jewish scoundrel transmits to his English clansmen for the purposes of practical propaganda. Our simple-minded political bourgeoisie cannot grasp the idea that today we don't have to fight for sea power. Even before the war, it was absurd to direct German national enemies towards this end without having first secured our position in Europe. Such a hope today rises to a stupidity that, in the political field, may be called criminal. It often becomes maddening to see how the Jewish wire pullers succeed in concentrating the people's attention on things that are only of secondary importance. They incited them to demonstrations and protests, while at the same time, France was tearing away at our national body, piece by piece, systematically removing the very foundations of our independence. And that will do it for today. This is recording 32, chapter 13, volume 2, Dalton translation of Hitler's Mein Kampf. And it'll have much more and more specific relations and states in the rest of the chapter. Anyway, thanks for being with me again, and we'll get back to the rest of the chapter 13 and finish it next time. And we'll do that real soon.